Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast, where we explore how to center our lives and our leadership in the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ.
In the midst of the disruptive cultural shockwaves of the 21st century.
Join us as we learn to take the love of God seriously as the force that holds all of us and everything together.
Well, good day, listener. This is Matt Tebbe. You're listening to the Gravity Podcast, joined as always by my friends in this co-labor of love, Christy Penley from Colorado Springs. Hello, Christy.
Ooh, hello.
Is it snowing there yet?
It did yesterday. And then snow's on the ground.
Is it still there? Did it melt?
It is still there because it's only like 25 degrees today, but I think it'll melt. And the sun's already out.
Great. Well, you can always count on that at least 350 times out of 365 times a year or something.
It's so true.
And Ben Sternke from his new house. Hello, Ben.
New house. Who dis? Is that what kids say?
That's what the kids say. Yeah.
I think so.
I'm the listener so hip. So hip. Doesn't realize how hip you are. Also,
yeah.
Ben, do I have this right? You bought this house because it was a better house to podcast in?
That's it. That was the sole reason. I was like, how can I organize my life around this podcast that I do? No, not for that reason. I actually still need to run an Ethernet cable to improve my internet connection in the room that I use to podcast. So, but it's sufficient, I think, for today.
Yeah. If I had a nickel for every time you encouraged me to run an Ethernet cable to my laptop, I could probably pay for someone to do that for you.
Yeah. No, I think you'd only have a dollar.
Is that it? Just a dollar?
Yeah, I mean, I probably only told you
just
that
20 times.
20 times. You'd have a dollar, and that would not be enough to pay somebody to run that cable.
I'd buy you a lollipop then.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, guys, we're going to do a new segment on our podcast for those who've been listening for a while. We're going to start out with sharing personal stories, news stories, or recommendations that we have from the past week because we've got lots of opinions and lots of things happen to us, you know? Collectively, we're parenting about, I don't know, 3 dozen people, and there's just a lot going on. So I wanted to share a personal story today. I had to get a physical a few months ago for like life insurance, health insurance reasons. And for some reason, you know, they tested my blood for tuberculosis.
And TB.
Or TB, as the kids call it. If you're from the 19th century and you're listening, consumption.
Consumption.
And
that's
it
what
came
Doc
back,
Holliday died from.
It came back positive, which was
that's a big deal.
Which was bonkers because like I got the vaccine for TB, like most of us did who are listening. And I don't have any symptoms, i.e., I'm not coughing up blood or dead. And so I went in for a chest x-ray because they're like, Let's see if this is active in your system. And the chest x-ray came back negative. And so throughout this entire ordeal, I've found out that a lot of us have TB in our system that is latent or asymptomatic. And for 90% of us who have that, nothing ever happens. It just kind of hangs out in your body, right? Not doing any damage. But for 10% of the people with latent or asymptomatic TB, it comes online and you actually get it, right? So the Fishers, my hometown, the town I live in, Fishers Health Department called me And they were like, hey, we want to put you on antibiotics to take care of this TB. And I was like, I don't really want to. Like, what does that entail? And she was like, well, it's free. The state pays for it. And it's just 4 months of antibiotics.
Only four months.
I mean, in the grand scheme of things, what's 4 months of antibiotics?
Well, when you get to be my age, Ben, you don't know. I'm on a ticking clock. I'm terminal.
Yeah. I mean,
as we all are.
Hopefully a little less terminal after these antibiotics.
I'm curious. If you're on antibiotics for 4 months, will you get the common cold this winter?
So this is what I don't understand. Like, I kind of think of, and maybe a doctor who's listening or one of those virologists. Is that what they're called? If you work for the
Did
CDC.
Did you make up that word? Hit us up.
I think that's real.
Virologist.
It's a person who studies viruses.
No, okay. I think... My brain
could
just
have made up
things.
The word, and it could be a real word. Yeah.
Okay. Well, my point is, I don't know. I tend to think of antibiotics as like, in a city of 1 million people, you've got 10,000 criminals. And so we're just going to drop a nuke on the city and hope we knock out the 10,000 criminals and keep enough of the 1 million people alive that, so it's like a really, it's a really sort of brutal way of dealing with disease rather than it's not a knife. You're like whacking things with a hammer, but maybe I'm wrong. I mean, maybe they create antibiotics to only go after certain things, but the health department official did say, Amy is her name. She did say that, that I could take some probiotics, so I've started drinking some kombucha in the evening. Okay. She did say that I can't drink any alcoholic drinks, which was a bit weird. Like, I was like, why? And she's like, well, this interacts with your liver. And she goes, and you'll notice that your tears may turn orange.
For real?
And yes. And not to get too gross, but your urine may be orange as well. And so I was like, okay, well. So I met up with Ben on Friday and I was like, I'm going to have a few beers. The last beers I'll have until Easter's.
It's and like Lent early.
He had like 16 beers. It was ridiculous.
I had a few beers. I woke up the next morning, took the antibiotic, and I'm not kidding you guys. I was, okay, the color of Mountain Dew?
Yeah.
Right.
Imagine mixing one part blood and one part Mountain Dew. Together, that was the color of my urine.
Like
it was
soda
bonkers, and I was like, "Am I dying? Is this death?" I think I had a little alcohol still in my system that morning. You know what I mean? It takes a while for the alcohol to leave your system. Anyway, the next 2 days, it's not been that crazy dark. Like, oh my gosh, what's happening? But the people tell you that if your urine is dark, you need to drink more water. Like, you got to stay hydrated. Right, you have to pee clear, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Well, there's no way for me to pee clear the next 4 months. It's just crazy. It's crazy. Yeah. And I'm like talking to my liver. I find myself just giving my liver a little pep talk. Like, I know this is hard for you.
Yeah.
Hey, buddy, I can tell. You're going to make it.
It's going to be okay.
I need you for this. Okay.
This won't be. This won't
Don't
last
poop
forever.
Out on me now. We got somebody at our church who's awaiting a liver transplant. And I know I'd be at least second in line. So, like, I need you. Keep on this.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm going, I'm dealing with that. And it's hard to talk about it because I think most people are like, oh my gosh, are you okay? Because TB is like deadly. And I'm fine, other than ADHD, PTSD, and being kind of
now
a jerk.
TB.
Now TB. I'm fine. Yeah. But it is a little, it's just not something I thought I'd be dealing with this December.
It's sort of alarming, right? I mean, the last time I thought about TB before, I mean, John Green, I follow him on Twitter. He's like this author, young adult author. And he does tuberculosis activism, actually. He's trying to make the drug more affordable because like Johnson & Johnson, I think, was like jacking up the price, especially in like overseas in Africa and other places like that where it's like a serious problem. And he actually succeeded in getting them to reduce the price to make it more affordable. I don't know if it's the same drug.
Good for him.
Or if this is maybe antibiotics to, I don't know. I'm not even sure.
Rimfampin. So. I think I'm saying that right. Rimfampin is what I'm taking.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know.
Anyway, thanks, John.
Yeah. Yeah. So John does that. But then the time before that, the last time I thought about tuberculosis was when I watched, is it the movie Tombstone, where Val Kilmer plays Doc Holliday, who's dying slowly of tuberculosis.
Yes.
So that's immediately what I thought of when you were like, I have TB. I was like, okay. Right, like right. I thought that was a old time problem. So no idea.
So my great grandmother died of TB.
Really?
And my grandma and my aunt both have it in their system because they were around her before she died.
Okay.
And so that it's like a real thing. Like they, you know, they had to take the, whatever you're doing to, and make sure that they were protected. Now, since my grandma has passed away and my aunt is like, you know, 80, but, yeah, it's crazy. It's like a real deal.
Yeah. This is really, I don't know. I got the vaccine. So people have asked me, how did you, when you had the vaccine, right? And we know vaccines aren't 100%, at least at some vaccines aren't 100%. But I wonder if the vaccine is preventing it from being more than just latent. You know, I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how any of that works. Again, if you work for the CDC, hit us up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're not virologists.
So I'll be drinking a lot of kombucha and trying to stay hydrated, even though my urine tells me I'm not. For the next 4 months. So if you think of it, pray for me.
Right on.
Okay. All right, y'all. Well, I got to go get my kids off to school.
Okay.
So we are.
Yes.
We are introducing.
Apologies, Christy. Yes.
Sorry. I just don't want them to be tardy. You know, they can only have so many
tardies. That's no good. Let's quickly get into this intro then. So we are talking with Scott McKnight today. This is part of our series on the Bible. Mm-hmm. Scott McKnight translated the New Testament, a new translation of the New Testament called the Second Testament. It's pretty fascinating. It was basically the translation philosophy here is not to make it sort of easier to read, but actually make it stranger to allow us to understand like the strangeness of, you know, Greek and like how different that is from English and sort of, it sort of makes the Bible, I think the way we titled this episode was, you know, making the Bible weird again, so that we can hear it again. So, this is a translation that makes the New Testament, weird and a little bit clunky. For good reason. It basically allows us to sort of see what's there in some new ways.
Rediscover its weirdness again.
Yeah. Rediscover the weirdness of the Bible. So, I'll just give you a quick example here. This is from the gospel passage for today in the Daily Office Lectionary, when Jesus enters the temple. So it just gives you a flavor for what this is like. Jesus entered into the temple and tossed out all the sellers and purchasers in the temple, and he tipped over the tables of the money changers and the chairs of those selling doves. He says to them, "It's written, my house will be called a prayer house, but you have made it a bandit's cave."
Oh, man.
Anyway. So it's kind of interesting, even like he says to them, like the present tense is there. And so I wonder, you know, how all that works. So anyway, I'm actually, now that Advent has begun, welcome to Advent, everybody. I have begun to read this for my kind of a regular scripture reading. And then there's an Old Testament version called the First Testament that John Goldingay translated. So I'm reading that as well. And it's making my Bible reading weird again.
Yes.
Yeah. Nice.
It's pretty fascinating. Wow. Anyway.
Good. Scott's always... Yeah, Scott's always up for a good. He's like a dude, and I like to hang out with Scott.
Baseball.
Yeah, we just give each. I mean, we also kind of razz each other a bit, you know, that kind of relationship with Scott. It's nice.
Yeah, it's fun to have Scott on. So this is the fun little interview, and hopefully this contributes, listener, to your enlightenment about what the heck the Bible is.
All right,
and how to read it. All right,
here we go.
Let's get into it.
Scott McKnight joins us once again on the Gravity Podcast. He's the Julius R. Manti Chair of New Testament at Northern Seminary in Lisle, Illinois, and the author of a lot of books, including Reading Romans Backwards, Pastor Paul, the King Jesus Gospel, and a number of commentaries on James, Galatians, and Colossians, among others. He's the also the general editor of IVP's Dictionary of Paul and His Letters, second edition. And he's recently written a new translation of the New Testament called the Second Testament. And we're talking about that with him today. Scott, welcome back.
Matt, good to see you. I don't know who all is on this podcast, so I'll say hi to Ben and Christy as well.
Yeah.
We know them for sure. Okay. Scott, middle of August, it looks like the Cubs were going to do it. They're going to make the playoffs. And then what happened? What happened to America's? What happened to God's team?
Matt, I have to tell you a story here that my son resigned from the Cubs.
He did.
He was with them for 20 years. And after 1 year, he was offered an amazing job with the Cleveland Guardians. So we cheer for the Guardians.
What?
And not the Cubs.
No.
That is totally true. We change our teams as often as LeBron James.
Goodness.
So the Cubs, you know, the Cubs, I think the Cubs just had an unfortunate spell at the end of the year because that's a pretty good team.
Yeah.
And they lost, nine out of 11 or something like that at one point. Mm-hmm. And you just can't hang on at the end of the year like that. And that's too bad.
They gave up
those runs in Atlanta. Wasn't it three games in a row they lost in Atlanta, two of them when they had good leads?
Yeah. And they played, you know, Atlanta and the Brewers down the stretch, who are both really good teams. So
yeah, they are good teams. Yeah.
Played some great teams. You know, speaking of your son, Scott, I still remember that Sammy Sosa story you told me, which we won't repeat here. And then I also saw
that wasn't from him though. He did not know that story. I learned that from another person.
Yeah, but you told me that anyway. I saw a picture of you and your son playing golf recently.
Yeah.
How often do you get to play golf?
Well, I play when Lucas or my grandson wants to play. I used to play at least once a week for about over 15 years. I used to play with colleagues at North Park once a week. And then when I left North Park 10 years ago, I just didn't have a team of people to go with. Yes. So I haven't played much in the last 5 years. But we played a wonderful course in Lake Geneva called the Highlands last week. And it was really fun. So that was good.
There's like not many things that beat a gorgeous day on a beautiful golf course with people you
That's
like.
Right.
Well, hey, wait, can I tell a story about my son since we're talking about sons and doing stuff with them? Because it has to do with Scott. So one of my sons turned 16 this year. And Scott, when our kids turn 16, we do like a, well, we're not Hispanic, but we have some Hispanic kids. So we do like a quinceañera type Penley version, even if they're a boy. So like we just kind of mix it all together and we do meaningful gifts by like meaningful people, purposeful gifts given by meaningful people. And the grandparents gave your book, the one we're talking about today, as their like meaningful gift to him for his 16th birthday. They all wrote in it and stuff. And it
was
awesome.
That's good. That's cool. That's fun.
That is cool.
Yeah. It was cute. Someone was like, wait, Dad, do you really know this guy? I was like, yes, we do.
Yes, that's right.
That's awesome. Well, Scott, you've written a lot on the New Testament. Obviously, probably had studied every single book of the New Testament before you decided to create this new translation. So maybe what went into the decision-making to do this, and what do you consider the unique offering that this translation brings?
Okay, this has to be explained. All right, Tom Wright he translated the New Testament. It became the Kingdom New Testament, but he did it for his Bible for Everyone. Is that what it was called?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it was an updating originally of William Barclay's famous series that many, many people bought. And he translates it, and it's a wonderful translation. And then they commissioned John Goldingay to do the Old Testament. Not so many people heard about that one, though. And John translated the Old Testament. But he translated the Old Testament in a significantly different way than Tom did the New Testament. So when it came out, I got the Bible for Everyone. That was the first time I saw Golden Gate's translation. And I was reading it, and I thought, whoa, this is completely different than Tom Wright. Then InterVarsity published, because Zondervan owns the rights to Tom Wright's Kingdom New Testament. But but they didn't own the rights to John Golden Gate. So InterVarsity, IVP Academic, bought the rights to Golden Gate's translation of the Old Testament, which he called the First Testament. And they produced a beautiful volume of it. And I have now read it three times. And when I read it the first time, I thought, this is a completely different translation. And it will, for people who care about the Bible, it will give them a different experience reading the Bible. It won't be like, it won't sound like you live in Indiana or Illinois, you know. It sounds like something like you've never sounded before. So when I was at SBL maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I was talking to the main editor, and I said, his name is John. I said, John, those two translations don't belong together. Those are two completely different theories of translation. He said, what do you think should be done? I said, I think you ought to commission someone to translate the New Testament. He said, would you do it? Well, I had never thought of it. And I said, yeah, I'll do that. I'd love to do that. And it's so, to me, it's not my theory of translation. It's a theory of translation designed to be compatible with Golden Gate's First Testament. That's why mine's called the Second Testament. And its distinctiveness is, let's say, transliterated names, which is anti-colonialism, in my opinion, at some level, is that it avoids making people's names our English equivalent. It leaves them in their world, you know. So it's Ioannes, it's not John. And now John, of course, is an English name, but it also has a history. And then it is an attempt to be, let's say, as little dynamic equivalence as is tolerable and still make sense in English. And at times when people say to me, that verse was a little hard to understand, I say, yes, that's a victory for me. I want you to feel what that Greek text actually feels like and what it looks like. Now, of course, a Greek doesn't think it's hard to understand, but we do. But I want them to experience a little bit more what the Greek text is like. Yeah. So that was, I tried to do for Greek what John Golden Gate did for Hebrew. Yeah. And it's not the same because Hebrew is not Greek.
And now, a word from a sponsor.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Just to give an example of this, Scott, and then before we go to the next question, like there's this translation that most of our listeners are used to that you mentioned in the introduction, like to prepare your minds for action. Yeah. This is 1 Peter 1:13. But you intentionally don't translate the sort of the Greek word picture. Would you just give us what do you translate that as? And then what are you hoping that kind of disturbance does for us?
Therefore, surrounding your mental waste with your robe, being sober, completely hope in the grace being carried to you at Jesus Christos's apocalypse. So, I think they had like surrounding the, I'm not sure how the translations go. What did you have it as?
Yeah, so the NRSV says prepare your minds for action. Yeah. And NIV says, with your minds that are alert.
Yes. It's all translating an image of, all right, now there's two ways of looking at it, is that people wore, like, let's say, a robe or a tunic, and they had to pull it up to their waist if they wanted to run. You can't run in a long dress very well, okay, mm-hmm. something like that. And if it's robish, then you have to kind of also tuck it in and surround your waist. So I tried to give the image. I mean, if you really wanted to be a full image, it would be pull up the bottom of your robe and tuck it into a belt around your waist. That's the idea. But it's a metaphor for mental readiness. So it's all your mental waist is the central idea. It's about the mind being prepared. So those dynamic equivalent translations are fine. They're good, but they don't give the picture that the Greek text gives. So I tried to give the Greek the picture.
Yeah. So maybe a way of talking about this then is, and I've read, you know, bits and pieces of both the First Testament and your Second Testament as well. Maybe for our listeners, like the picture here is, most translations will take the image that's there in the Greek and give us the idea that the image is meant to convey, right? And so it's like, oh, what does that metaphor mean? Well, here, we'll just give you that in English. And that might make it easier for people to understand, you know, what that metaphor means, right? And what it's doing there. But your translation, it seems like it seeks to not make that jump and actually make it a little bit more strange for us to say, here's the picture. So I'm going to give you the actual picture in the language of the Greek. So, in some ways it feels like it's making the Bible strange again.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what I was trying to do. And it's typical. Those are that what you talked about, the normal translation is called a dynamic equivalent.
Right.
So the idea is that here's the original language and here's the receptor language. This is what this expression meant or intended to convey in that context. Mm. What is the equivalent dynamic expression in this context? And that's considered faithful translation. And I agree with that, depending on context. But because of what Goldingate did, I thought this is a different experience of the Bible. I want to try to do this for the New Testament. So I'm not really criticizing current translations.
Right.
I'm providing a different way. And I've been irritated by some of my friends who said, well, I don't agree with your theory. Well, it's not about that. It's about whether this theory is compatible with Goldingay and whether this will give people a different sense of what the text says. a different feel. And that's what I'm trying to do. So it's, there's a lot of fun to do this. There's a lot of work too. There's a lot of work. Here's the hard part for me. John Goldingay did something that I thought was really important. And that is try to use the same English word for the same Greek word every time. Now, there are sometimes this is impossible. Even like the word pistis, which is translated faith. Sometimes it means faith. Sometimes it means trust. Sometimes it means the faith. Mm-hmm. If I just use trust, it won't work. It'll be something, you know, what's your, you know, this is the message of our trust. Well, that just isn't going to work. So I did flex, but I only flexed reluctantly and if I could be persuaded otherwise. Mm-hmm. I try to use the same English word, and at times this really works well. And at other times, I'm asking the readers some special forgiveness so that I can use that same English word. So. Yeah.
It's been fascinating hearing my son Soren read it and then be like, wait a minute, I thought I knew this verse, and then like goes back to another translation, right, that he's like familiar with. I'm curious for you, Scott, what did you learn new? Like what changed in your interpretation of a text in as you wrote this project? Were you surprised by anything?
Well, Christy, this is so true. I bet 500 times I've read Goldingay and said to myself, I don't think I've ever read this verse before. And so I would go to my RSV or my NRSV to see what I had, or the NIV. One of the things I wanted to do was give a feel for the Greek quality of different authors, because Matthew and Mark do not operate at the same level as Luke in the book of Luke and Acts. John operates differently. Even Paul's letters, they're not all alike. The pastoral epistles is significantly different than the, let's say, Romans and Galatians. And Revelation is different. Jude is in another world. Second Peter is like that. So I wanted to be literal enough that people could feel different authors. It's a little different to make that happen as easily as you want it to happen. But at the same time, I think if someone reads, let's say, the whole of Matthew at once and then the whole of Luke, they'll feel the distinctness of each author. But if they're reading a passage a day, a page a day, it's just not going to happen. Surprises. I was surprised how challenging the Greek is in the second half of the book of Acts. And I've talked to scholars who are Acts scholars, Luke Acts scholars. And I've said, have you translated the whole book of Acts? And I have not found one person yet who had. Now, I'm sure Craig Keener has. I haven't asked him this question. But I'm really surprised by the number who haven't. So Acts was a lot of fun for me, seeing how the language worked with him. So, you know, because I've been teaching the New Testament for so long, there weren't stunning surprises to me. It was just the daily absorption in the text. I'll tell you one that really irritates me, though, is the NIV can't get the word ergon, works. They have a nervous habit, and it's a theological bias, that when erga, works, is negative, they translate it as works. And when it's positive, they translate it as deeds. And it, in my opinion, it destroys the continuity between good works and good deeds that we're all called to do good works. Well, now you can't do good works in the NIV. You have to do good deeds. And I don't think that's good. I tried oh, yeah, some things that were a little bit edgy. John is not John the Baptist, but John the Dipper, because the Greek word baptizo means to dip. And I translated the Empire of God rather than the Kingdom of God. I don't think kingdom means a whole lot in English to most people.
No.
When I use the word empire, I think people go, whoa, that's a little strange and strong, and that's what I want to do. And Christy, what you said happened in your family is exactly what I want. I want people to say, well, I'm not sure I agree with this. So they go to another translation. Well, that's a win for me, is that I've got people thinking about what that text means. Yeah. That's the desire. Yes. Slow down. And of course, I'm defamiliarizing people with the translations as well. So,
Yeah, that's good. That's actually necessary work. You know, it's sort of the way we see people in the New Testament learn about the kingdom of God and Jesus, is they have to slow down and ask questions and get disoriented. So in some ways, your translation's doing very much what the eternal word did in his earthly ministry, Scott.
Thank you.
Well, let's have some fun here. I'm curious to ask specific decisions that you made and then to speak into larger ramifications of those decisions. So let's take Philippians 3:8, everybody's favorite curse word, Paul passage. I'll read it for us. Okay. I'll read your translation.
Right, this is Scott's translation. Okay. All right.
This is Scott's translation. I consider all matters, this is Paul, to be a forfeit because of the higher status of knowing Christos Jesus, my Lord, because of whom I have forfeited all matters, and I consider them to be feces, so I may gain Christos. All right, so many interpreters here, Scott, as you know, consider Paul to have cursed, used a word that is probably, they would say, should be translated shit. This word, skubala. So two questions here. Why didn't you give a shit here, Scott? And two, maybe more ethically, pastorally, what does Paul's use of words like this mean for our language decisions today? What conclusions can we
draw? All right. So this was in the lectionary this week. So I'm glad that you're paying attention to this. As Episcopalians, you would have gotten caught up into this text, perhaps. All right. So I was prepared to use a less finessed word for skubala. I don't think InterVarsity IVP Academic would have permitted shit as the translation. But they would have loved to have gotten negative press, because it would have sold a lot of copies to people looking for junk. But here's the thing. So there's a long chapter of a guy that Mike Bird put me on to. I think it was Bird. So I checked out the book, ordered an interlibrary loan, and it demonstrated that this word skubala does not belong to the register of vulgarity, but to a register of medical word. It's much more frequent in medical words.
Interesting.
So I thought, what's a good medical equivalent, you know?
Excrement, feces, those kinds of things.
I did think of excrement. I thought of that. But here's one of the things. My editor is really clever. He said, use shorter words, not longer words.
Yeah.
So those were my two conclusions, excrement or feces. And I thought feces is the shorter word. I'll use feces.
Yeah.
So that's the process. So, all right.
Then we can't really draw ethical conclusions then from using vulgarities from a medical term.
Yeah. I mean, Paul was snarky in the book of Acts when he smarted off to the high priest. Mm-hmm. And Paul is, you know, in that same passage, you know, it's not in the lectionary. Paul is pretty harsh on people at the beginning of Philippians chapter 3, calling them dogs.
Dogs.
So there's, I think that In this passage, Paul uses a graphic term that everybody would have connected to and thought, ooh, that's pretty serious stuff. And so yeah. I think that there's a time to use a word that would shock the audience into attention.
Yes.
And I think we could learn that. That's good okay. writing to do that, is to use a word yeah. that stuns people, grabs their attention, says, ooh, I didn't know I would think of it that way.
Yeah. So dogs and excrement, other places he says people should cut off their marriage tackle. You know, this is language of somebody.
That's the dynamic equivalent. Yeah. There you go.
I have one more. And then
you
maybe
see what
Christine
I call
then,
this paragraph, incisionist, circumcisionist, and rightness.
All right. So let's talk just peculiar verses. I don't know if you've ever had a life verse, Scott, when you were a young youth grouper, if you ever picked a life verse. But I often kind of poke fun at these things. And I say that depending upon my mood, either Titus 1:12 or 1 Corinthians 14:18 are my life verses. 1 Corinthians 14:18 is, I praise God that I speak in tongues more than any of you, which I just think is a funny, cheeky way to boast at other people's expenses. But Titus 1:12, your translation, and I'll include the beginning of 13 as well, is someone of them, one of their own prophets, said, Cretans are always falsifiers, bad beasts, worthless guts. This witness is true. All right, so here's my question, Scott. I think verses like this give people trouble, right? Especially if you're from Crete. Help us understand how you conceive of, maybe we can talk like inspiration here in places like this. How does this vert fit into your understanding of God inspiring humans to write divinely inspired texts?
On the island of Crete, in the city of Heraklion, that's the main port city, they have a beautiful church dedicated to Titus. So they weren't that bothered by this verse.
They got over it.
I was with a tour group of students, and we took over a chapel, which is supposed to be public, and the door is supposed to be open, and we shut the door. We kind of pretended like we were in charge, and I gave a little lecture on the life of Titus in that room. It was pretty fun. This is something that is pretty important to me. I think our view of the Bible has to be connected to what the Bible is, rather than what we want it to be. Okay, so here's my standard example. I hate the story of Jephthah in the book of Judges. All right? It finishes, he does to his daughter according to his vow, which is a nice little indirection of murder. Okay? Slaughters. Offers her as a sacrifice. Pretty gross. Terrible, barbaric. It bothers me even more that the book of Hebrews in chapter 11 lionizes Jephthah. Okay? All right. That's our Bible. That's how I read that and I go, really? And I think that's part of what scripture reading is. It is part of what Jews do with the Bible. Rabbis, they're always kind of discussing things and going back and forth. I don't know about this. They didn't have this sort of magical, ethereal, idealistic theory of scripture. They recognized human authorship and divine communication at the same time. They're not bothered by the fact that Exodus says you cannot boil the Passover lamb. And Deuteronomy says, boil the Passover lamb. They don't find that to be, they think, well, that's kind of fun. We got it here and we got it here. They're not, and so I believe that we have to construct a theory of Scripture that is based on what we actually encounter in Scripture. And when we look at a text and we go, it's cringeworthy, That's okay. I think that's a legitimate response to the text, the murderous actions of Jewish harem warfare, I think are cringeworthy. And if we don't have that view of the Bible, then we end up concocting a reading that ordinary people look at it and you go, you must be paid to do this, to come up with that kind of reading, because that's not the way I'm experiencing this text. And I think honesty and transparency about these texts is the way to come to the true sense of what Scripture actually does.
Mm. Yeah.
That's a good word.
That is a good word. So can I or can I not call somebody I don't like a workless gut?
Yeah. I think that you probably should be very careful where you use it, because labels, you know, Jesus used a lot of labels. And labeling is it's been studied a lot in scholarship about how labels work. Labels sort of create boundaries between groups.
Yeah.
And they identify people, and you get identified yourself by the way you talk about other people. And calling people names was very common in the Jewish world. It's all the literature does this. Mm. And it's a way of distinguishing yourself from others. So today we find this to be, you know, I grew up, my mother taught me all the time, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. It's utterly foolish to say that. Because words do hurt.
Yeah.
So I look at that kind of language and I think, you know, Paul, that's you in your day. We don't do that anymore. So I don't like it when I'll use some of your friends, Tabby, some of the Gospel Coalition people say that, well, Jesus talked this way or Paul talked this way, so we're going to too. No, yeah. I don't think that's a proper approach.
Yeah.
They also wore sandals in dust, and they also didn't ever use deodorant, and they also didn't comb their hair and all that sort of thing. So I don't think that's the way to approach it. I think it is to say this was the way those people spoke in that day, and we need to pay attention to how we use these kinds of words.
Yeah.
Yes. Although if you're thoroughly consistent and you want to wipe your butt with your left hand, then maybe you get a dispensation.
That's right.
To use. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, you got to go all in.
Yeah, that's right.
Can I use modern argument. Plumbing? You know,
you got to go all in or else it's just trying to justify.
We'll be right back.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, our 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn how to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life that God shares with us. It is a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying out some new practices. In the Gravity Formation course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it's helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show.
Maybe we can ask another question, translation question. I think that's interesting about your translation. You chose to translate what we normally see in most translations, the word apostle. You translated that as commissioner. For example, Romans 16:7, which says this, greet Andronicus, I guess is maybe how you pronounce it. Greet Andronicus and Eunia, my relatives and my co-prisoners who are distinguished in the commissioners and who were in Christos before me. I wonder, Scott, what the significance is for you of using the word commissioner instead of apostle. And then
you know, help us understand what Paul is and isn't saying about Eunia here.
Andronikos. Okay. Andronikos. So, all right, here. The Greek word apostolos, we translate apostle, and that is a religious term.
Today.
Yeah. It is. It's a special term. It's a title.
Right.
That word was not a title like that. And the Hebrew word shaliach, it means someone who has been sent. And this is an official sending, and official sent ones are called commissioners. So every time that word shows up, it's, you know, when it shows up at the beginning of letters, people go, ah, that's weird. I've never thought of Paul as a commissioner. He was a commissioner. He was commissioned. It's a longer word than I wanted to use, but I couldn't find a shorter word as an equivalent. So, but it functions in the way commissioners work that, let's say, in the political world, in the economic world, people have been commissioned to do something. They've been officially sent by an organization, an institution to represent someone. That's what the word means. Okay, Eunia. Eunia is a name for a woman. And in the history of the church, Eunia was changed to Eunias, because there was a conviction that this person was actually an apostle who are distinguished in or among the apostles or the commissioners. So therefore, it couldn't have been a female. So therefore, we'll invent a male's name. So they changed, I guess you could say this, they changed the sex or the gender of this woman to a man to make her suitable for a Christian understanding of an apostle or a commissioner. Mm-hmm. But over time, and this was especially the case, you know, in the Reformation era, over time, people began to realize that, number one, the word Eunius, never appears as a male's name. So now you got a non-existent male in the New Testament. And eventually, and it really wasn't until 1979, I believe, was the date, although it was recognized from the beginning of the 20th century, that Eunia was a better reading and not Eunius. And then I think it was in 1979 that the standard Greek text put Eunia in the text and demoted Eunius. And I think that the best ones don't even mention Eunius. And I think it's even right for an Anabaptist pacifist to slay a non-existent male.
Because he doesn't exist anyway.
That's right. That's right. So you can kill people who don't exist, males. So it is an unfortunate reality that in the history of the church, there was such a conviction that this person was an apostle that it could not have been a woman. So therefore, we'll change it to a man. What is now interesting is that there are a lot of people who are questioning whether this person was actually an apostle because it's a woman. So now it's flipped the other way. It couldn't be, because it's a commissioner or an apostle, it couldn't be a woman. Now, because it is a woman, it can't be a commissioner, an apostle. It's got to be on the part, you know, in other words, distinguished by the commissioners. Mm-hmm. You know, the Greek word is en, and it means in. It could mean by, but everybody knows that St. Chrysostom made the statement in the 4th century, maybe it was the late 3rd century, I know it was the 4th century, the Chrysostom said that this was a woman who was esteemed among the apostles, so as an apostle. So, that Eunia is a woman who's an apostle in the 1st century, and they are relatives of the Apostle Paul.
So much for the plain reading, huh?
Plain readings work fine as long as it's plain.
Yeah. I guess my thought is people really like the idea of the plain reading until it goes against their assumptions about who can be an apostle. And then it's like, well, that can't be what Paul means.
I used to always say to my students when I was teaching at North Park, I don't think I've said it at Northern so much, is it's in your Bible and it's in mine. It's right there. Read it. That's what it says. That's at times you can make, it's pretty plain readings. You know, there's some, but other times there's complexities.
Absolutely.
Well, Scott, can you help us? You use bolded text in Romans, 1 Corinthians, as you translated this. Can you tell us what the bolded text indicates and why did you choose to do that? What were you trying to help us see that we'd otherwise miss?
Okay. Yeah, the bold text. And the publisher, the publisher was very patient with me because I wanted to do all kinds of things with translations that they did not think would work. And when you have two columns, even indention, what do they call them? Block texting gets really confusing. But I tell them all the time, you just look at the quotation marks of John Goldingay's translation, and you got 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 levels of quotations, and it gets really goofy. Okay. One of the things that I observed, Christy, in working on a book on Romans called Reading Romans Backwards, is the stunning number of questions that the Apostle Paul asks in Romans 2 through 4 and 9 through 11, 10, something like that. A little bit after that, but. And some of this stuff occurs in 1 Corinthians. And then following those questions, Paul answers his questions. So I see Romans 2 through 4. I put the questions in bold font to give people a sense that Paul is asking these questions and then he's going to answer these questions. I believe these are the types of questions Paul was asked in his mission work among Jewish believers, or among Jews and Jewish believers who became believers. And then they wanted to know, do we practice the law? And they were asking on the behalf of their family because can I eat pork? You know, and pork's not bad, but shrimp, what's the problem here? This is really good and we can have this sort of thing. So it's a question and answer feel that happens with the bold face in my translation. And I hope to give people a feel for how this is working rhetorically. So that's what that was about. The publisher was, we really struggled getting this right, but I haven't found a mistake with it yet, but I'm sure I will. It's this was really difficult for editing. For me, because it's my translation, and I'm not an editor, I'm an author. And so I don't read the way editors read, proof texters. The problem with the editors at InterVarsity was they have to let my words go because they're not editing my text. They are just, and they don't know, you know, they do know Greek and Hebrew, but they're not going to look at the Greek and Hebrew, or the Greek for this New Testament, they're not going to look at the Greek all the time. It just takes forever. It took me 4 months to go over my translation. And when I knew at the end that we were crunched a little bit for time, I thought, it's not work because I'm not a very good editor. I'm going to read this and I'm going to miss all kinds of things. And we're finding some mistakes, and the great thing about digital world is you can correct them. So,
yeah, that's good. Yeah. You know, you mentioned already Tom Wright's translation, and then pretty soon right around that time, David Bentley Hart released his New Testament translation with his fascinating apparatus that he wrote. Fascinating. But Scott, one of the best things that happened to both Tom Wright and David Bentley Hart is that they went after each other in subsequent articles. I don't know if you remember that. So I'm just praying somebody really hates your translation, you know, and gives you the attention that they gave each other.
I don't know of that happening. I mean, I haven't. Here, it's an interesting thing. Is I read that debate. Those two, David Bentley Hart.
They were fascinating.
That's
debates,
right. David
they?
Bentley Hart likes polemics, and Tom's not afraid to back. He's not afraid to stand up for stuff that. David Bentley Hart's translation is really. When I first came out, I thought I really like this idea. What he's doing, I got really annoyed by all the uses of "and" for Kai. If you're going to use a period, you can't use "and," because the "chi" in Greek is virtually a period in English. That's the equivalent. That was part of it. But I found and it bothered me. I found a lot of mistakes in David Bentley Hart's translation, and it bothered me when I found. I got irritated with him at times, but it bothered me thinking, this is going to happen to me too. And, you know, Tom had someone, they SBCK paid someone to go through his whole translation. He told me they found two or three verses that he had not even translated. Oh, wow. He just skipped. That's the way text critics works. You skip things. And so this person found that and they made a lot of corrections. And then they had a lot higher level of a lot stronger sense of editing at times. It's interesting, I had three editors, but two wonderful editors, Anna Gissing and Rachel Hastings, and I just thought they did a wonderful job. And, you know, I take responsibility for every mistake that we find, little glitches, and one time it has the word form, and it means it's supposed to be from, and... what bothers me is this is the Bible. This isn't a book. Yeah. This is the Bible.
Right, right.
People are reading it carefully. And we have a guy named Adam who's been writing. He sent me about a dozen little glitches that he's found. And they're not real big ones, like Jesus with an apostrophe, not an extra S, stuff like that. But he's finding them. And the editor at InterVarsity said, maybe we should hire him to be an editor. He's doing such a good job. It's really, really difficult. That was hard.
It's so hard. Yeah. Yeah. It's so hard. Well, I heard that Hart's putting out a second edition.
It's already out from what I've heard. It's out. I don't have a copy of it, but yeah. Yeah.
Well, Scott, I appreciate the work you've done in this translation. And anytime I'm doing sermon prep, I'm using NRSV and CEB. But then and when it's New Testament, I always go to Wright and Hart, and now I'll go to yours as well, just to see what these translations don't show us, or maybe what's hidden, or what needs to be seen. So I just appreciate
that. Thank you. I'm a big NRSV fan. I started with the RSV in college. I went to the NRSV, and I especially liked it when the nonsense people got mad that it was inclusive translation. So I thought, come on, leave this alone. So then I'm now using the NRSV updated edition.
Yeah.
So
updated edition. Yep.
Yeah, Ben, did you hear that? He took another shot at my Gospel Coalition friends.
Yep. Yep.
And that's good.
That was expert level trolling of Matt, by the way. So thank you, Scott.
Scott, you were sharing before we hit record what you're working on now. It's a book on Jesus and the Pharisees. You want to say a bit about that?
I've been on a life journey trying to purge myself of, I don't think it's anti-Semitism and even anti-Judaism. It's just an inaccurate understanding of Pharisees. Yes. And I learned about this in my PhD days by reading E.P. Sanders and The New Perspective and trying to see Judaism in a different way. But over the years, what I've found in myself is I make a strong point that we got to treat the Pharisees correctly. And the next thing I know, I have said something that actually uses them as a foil where they don't need to be a foil.
Right.
In other words, Amy Jill Levine is my prophet on this. She says, Jews don't have to look bad to make Jesus look good. Mm. And we do this all the time. So I have found over the years that I've made mistakes on this, and this is my attempt to get the record straight as I can get it. But I'm trying to present a wider, bigger view of who the Pharisees are and how they work. It's called strategic field theory. If you construct a field, Jesus and the Pharisees, in a sense, are sort of competing for the same audience. And what were Jesus' strategies? What were the strategies of the Pharisees and scribes? And why are they always connected to scribes and sometimes Herodians? And why do they come from Jerusalem? And what is their relationship to the temple authorities and Caiaphas and the family of Annas and Pontius Pilate and Antipas? So I'm working a wider lens on the Pharisees and Jesus as he builds what I call the Kingdom Coalition. So,
yeah. Well, we'll have you back on to chat about that. But real quick, 30 seconds. We had a rabbi on, and she said Jesus was a Pharisee in the school of, was it Hillel?
Hillel versus Shammai. Argued,
yeah.
I think she said he was a Hillel Pharisee. This is why he reserved his harshest critique and rhetoric for them, and he argued with them all the time, and this was normal Jewish stuff. And they what say you, Scott? Was Jesus a Pharisee?
Well, no, I don't think he was a Pharisee. I think he was critical, but he was within that game. He's playing the same game of what's the proper interpretation of the law of Moses for the people of God, for the crowds, for the ordinary person. So he's he didn't see them as enemies in that sense. They were competing for the same crowd, but they differed. And so, and it's a standard sociological thing, isn't it, that the people that we are most vehement in disagreement with are people who are closest to us, because they're going to, they rob us of our identity. So, yes, he was close to them.
Yeah, what I take away from that comment, Scott, is you confessing that you really are close to the Gospel Coalition. The book, again, is called The Second Testament, A New Translation. Scott, thanks so much for being with us
today.
And
thank you for your affirmation of the Gospel Coalition so often.
Y'all, Scott's a lot of fun.
Yes. Yep.
He's a good man too.
Yes.
Like, I really like him.
I appreciate how he is able to pivot between being really serious and being really silly. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that needs to be celebrated more in our culture. You know.
Yeah. He's the real deal.
Yeah.
He's a good guy.
Yeah. And you know, in terms of like teaching the New Testament, thinking about the New Testament, you know, he's published a commentary on almost every book in the New Testament at this point, now a translation. And I want to reflect. He sounded a lot like Chris Green when he shared about what to do with like the texts that bother us, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He sounded a lot like our conversation been with Chris.
Yeah, yeah. You were not on that one, were you, Christine?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was close to the beginning of this series where, I think that. Just as I think it can't be said often enough for people, because a lot of us grew up in an environment where it was not considered faithful to have a problem with the Bible or have a problem with something the text says God did and think, well, that's terrible, right? It was just like you could never even have that immediate reaction.
Yeah.
And so I appreciated him sharing that. That's like, if we're going to find out how God is speaking to us through this story, we have to be willing to deal with the story and our reactions to the story. Like, that's part of how I think the Bible works, yes, is that there's this conversation that we can begin to have with God about the events that are conveyed in this text. anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, you know, you mentioned sermon prep. But one of the things I'm thinking I'm going to do with Golden Gay's translation and Scott's translation is I pick a different translation, like every year, like the liturgical year that starts in Advent, mm-hmm. for the daily readings that I read every day in the Bible. I pick a translation. And so this year it's the Common English Bible, which is a very good modern dynamic equivalent translation. But I think I'm going to do Golden Gay and McKnight next year. Just read their texts. Yeah. So I think it'll be fun to make the Bible weird for every day. The Bible will be weird for me again. So yeah. I'm looking forward to that.
I hadn't even heard of Golden Gay's translation. So I might have to check it out.
It's very good. Yeah, it's similar. It feels similar, very similar to McKnight's. Obviously, he modeled it on Golden Gay's translation of the Old Testament. But I've consulted it several times, you know, when I'm doing sermon prep or sometimes just when I'm reading and I'm curious, you know, how something got translated. And especially in the Hebrew, there's so much more, I think there's like a lot of more ambiguity mm-hmm. in how to like create English text out of these Hebrew words that often Golden Gay's translation like is delightfully strange. I'm just like, what in the world is going on here? So, names are all unfamiliar, you know, because he does the same thing. He transliterates the Hebrew names rather than translating them into their sort of English equivalents. And so I don't even, so half the time I'm like, who is this? I can't even figure out who this is, but it makes the Bible feel so fresh. And like, I don't know this text as well as I thought I did.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I got to get out of here, guys, because I got to take my son to the gym.
That's great.
He's working out these days, he likes to go with dad to the gym. But that reminds me, did you guys hear about the superhero with the lisp who always works out?
No, tell us.
He's Thor.
Terrible.
All right.
There you have it, folks.
Just all right,
there
you terrible. Have
it. See you, everybody. All
right. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you're finding it helpful or enjoyable, we'd love it if you'd tell your friends about it.
Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And you can join our Gravity community online for free at gravityleadership.com/join.
You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as our email most Fridays with curated links to articles we find interesting and helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
Our podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the show. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com.
We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravityleadership.com/message and click the Start Recording button.
You can also email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.